You are listening to the Vorpal Chainsword Podcast, a podcast where I interview guests about D&D, miniatures, wargaming, comic books, movies, game conventions, and other nerd-related paraphernalia. So sit back, relax, and enjoy the show. Hello and welcome to the Vorpal Chainsword Podcast. I have with me Benoit Poré on the line. Benoit is an author, publisher, cartographer, whose work has recently been featured in Gygax Magazine as well as AFS Magazine. In 2013, he started the GP Adventures with his good friend Ernie Gygax. Welcome to the Vorpal Chainsword Podcast, Benoit.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, so I wanted to ask you about GP Adventures. I know it's an old school D&D publishing company you guys are starting, and can you tell me a little bit about it?
Right, that's this is basically my partnership with Ernie Gygax. And when we started this this project, that is, like, I came into the picture completely by chance, right? And Ernest basically saw my stuff online, and we decided to kick it off together. We got along really well, and from there the project evolved. That is, we wanted to renovate the hobby shop dungeon, which was like the dungeon that Ernie created in 1978 and was running at the Dungeon Hobby Shop at the time of TSR in Lake Geneva, and hence the name, right? So, and so when we started this project, it was about, you know, like prettifying the thing, right? So redrawing the maps and so on and so forth. As it evolved, we came to modify some things here and there. We talked about some of our concepts that Ernest didn't explore in the past. And basically, the renovation became an evolution of the Hobby Shop Dungeon into something that could be appealing to more gamers. That is, like, we want to deliver the experience of the Hobby Shop Dungeon that people expect from a Lake Geneva dungeon, right? People who have been waiting for the Castle Greyhawk for years and I've never gotten it, right? And at the same time, we want to be able to say to game masters, you are masters of your own games, and if that's the way you want to play it, you can, and if you want to use it another way, you can as well, and provide the tools and advice to customize the setting, use it in other play styles, and so on and so forth, right? So GP Adventures was built around this idea, right? Progressively.
Right. Yeah. Now, you wrote an adventure I recently read in AFS Magazine.
Right.
Now, that came out after you started GP Adventures, right? That wasn't one of the adventures that Ernie contacted you about.
No. Ernie at the time had no idea about it, but it came out just after I started work with Ernie, or just before. Just around the time I started work with Ernie. And yeah, that was basically my first foray into publishing something out of the internet sphere, because before I had, you know, like, done some how to build a dungeon online and all sorts of things, but I've never been published into a magazine or a fanzine of any sort. I mean, except ages ago, back in France, and when I was like 25 years old or something like that. And that piece in the FS magazine is that was really an experiment for me. I was trying to explore some concepts of game design I had been toying with for quite a few months prior. Basically, decided that I really wanted to present a dungeon not in a way that is set, like you see so often in modules, right? Where the dungeon has to be played a certain way and everything is described in excruciating detail. And I wanted to be much more loose on the presentation and say, well, here's how I played it in my game. Now, here's what you could do with your game, and you could go completely crazy with it if you want to, right?
Yeah, And I wanted to talk to you about that, because that's a great way to present the adventure. I read it, and I loved it, because you presented... so the one I'm talking about is called the Hyperborean Laboratory.
That's right. This is
and Cave System. That's in that magazine. And it has a map that's very similar to the ones you're... producing for Hobby Shop Dungeon. Like the drawing style is great. It, I don't know if it's colored pencils or what, but it looks awesome.
Anyway, go ahead.
So how you wrote it up was really interesting. Usually when we get these adventures, it's like the Baron has kidnapped the princess. Here's the first encounter they'll encounter on the road. And you presented a map, which is kind of like a sandbox, but at the same time, as you read through it, you realize there is a plot line in there. There is something going on inside the dungeon that could be, you know, a lot of triggers or hooks for the players to get in there, rather than just like a hex sandbox game where it's, oh, do they go to, you know, 1A, then this random encounter is there, you know, that is already written up for you. Mm-hmm. But and then you write and you have it separated into what you did in your campaign and then suggestions for other campaigns, which is great, because like the pillars that grab you and teleport you to other parts of the room,
right.
I love, and because they're terrifying, they slowly reach out and get you, and if you let them, they'll take you, they'll just teleport you, but it doesn't look like that to the players.
Absolutely.
You know, right? They're
right, like usually when you see a teleporter in the module that looks like a Stargate, or you know, like a wire that you can go through,
yeah.
Or a mirror,
yeah.
Or something like that, and I really wanted to present something that was interactive, right? The teleporter itself was interactive, and at the same time, I wanted it to be scary, right? And
right.
And potentially spawn something interesting in the game if it went completely awry, right?
So right, right. So and it's great how it's described, because it's like it looks like a pillar made of clay that's kind of wet, and if a player gets near it, you say, you know, hands slowly reach out and try to pull them in, which no player is going to let happen.
That's
if
right.
They see it.
That's right.
And then, and if they do, though, it's just taking them to another part of the dungeon. But then, of course, you say other ideas are it totally disintegrates them. You know, but
yeah,
which
it could at least, or
right,
yeah,
it could. It's
yeah.
One of the options, or fax them exactly. To the other side where it's just a doppelganger of them. So great old school stuff in there, but at the same time, really original ideas for a dungeon of that kind. And yeah, it's a great find. And I'm not going to describe too many parts in it because I'm actually going to use it in my own campaign.
Excellent.
So,
awesome.
So,
yeah. To hear that. Yeah.
Yeah. I loved reading it. And
well, you know, when you're
writing
something like this, that's always the point of this thing. Like, ultimately, you know, like when you start a business, you want to see it grow and whatnot, blah, blah, blah. But
yeah.
Ultimately, you're writing these things to see gamers enjoy it and play them at their own game table. You see what I mean? So that's always
right.
Awesome to hear something like that. Yeah.
Right. Right. Yeah. So I'm assuming this is kind of how your stuff for GP Adventures is going to go into the future, right? You're going to kind of have a map, and I constantly refer to the map as I'm reading the adventure to know what's
yes,
going
like,
on.
It's
very map-based.
I wanted to come back on that, yeah, because like when you look at the very early modules for TSR, like I'm talking really classics now. I'm talking Keep on the Borderlands, Lost mm-hmm. Cavern of Sushkans, scenarios like that. Like what these modules really do or did before Dragonlance was mm-hmm. present an adventuring location, maybe with one or two hooks into it. Like if you mm-hmm. look, if I remember currently, the Lost Caverns start with one possible scenario in which the local duke hires the player characters, but it's specifically pointed out as one of the many possibilities in which the party could get involved in exploring the area, right? So, and
right.
That's basically the idea behind this, that like if you look at the Dungeon Master's Guide, the Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 1st Edition Dungeon Master's Guide, there is no mention anywhere of plot lines, story, anything like that.
Yeah.
The game was really, at that point, was really built around exploring the unknown. And that basically was the point of the game. After whatever excuse you made up for it, was kind
right.
of off-camera and whatnot, the point of the game was to actually explore the dungeon, you know, overcoming the challenges and getting the treasure, right? So, but that actually offers a lot of possibilities for a lot of different play styles, because when you have just the adventuring setting, then you can plug onto a plotline if you want. Whereas if you start a module by having an assumption of a plotline, it's much harder to take the plotline out of it.
Yeah.
You see what I mean?
Yeah.
So that's
yeah,
an excellent,
yeah, I totally do.
That's an excellent start as a module to be able to allow GMs to do whatever they want with it, right? So that's that.
Yeah. And a lot of adventures like have, okay, this player is the noble son of, you know, you have a chosen, you don't make the plot around necessarily the character, because then if they die or that player can't come back anymore, like can't come to game anymore, your campaign's kind of ruined. And I mean, it's happened to all of us as we've made these, you know, here's the resurrected king, you know, and oh, you're that. But these are location-based, and then the players justify themselves why they're going in there.
The old-school solution to this is to just not play a story at all. It's to basically run the world. Personally, I always describe it as when I run a game, I'm role-playing the world just like a player would role-play his character. And from there, anything can happen whatsoever.
Yeah.
Mike Mornard, I don't know if you know him.
I'm aware. Yeah,
Mike Mornard, you had this wonderful phrase when somebody was talking about, you know, developing stories for D&D, and he was like, no. D&D isn't about the story. D&D is about the world. It isn't about the cast of character. It's about the world. And when you change that focus, everything changes in the game, and the game opens up in a way that it might not in some other aspect. When you use a storyline, other aspects of the game are going to open up, like character development and so on and so forth. But, so that's the difference was interesting from that standpoint.
I do kind of the same thing when I'm writing, like running like a con game or a game I feel like has to have a story that compresses into 5 hours. Then I'll actually think of just, I'll only pay attention to what the villain is doing as far as thinking of it. Like, what's their plot line if the adventurers didn't exist, right? And then I'll play it, and suddenly the adventurers will be in the game, and I'll try to respond, you know, as if I know what happens if the adventurers don't come, right? He'll pull off whatever evil thing he does, and then try to respond that way, rather than think, you know, which we all used to do or do when we starting, is like, okay, there's this room they're going to encounter first, then they're going to be slightly damaged for this second room.
Right.
Nope, don't care anymore. They get where they got to go, and they'll get there because they want to. And it's not like, and if you make it too obvious that some, you know, the characters are the special, I don't know, chosen ones, then they're going to feel like they can never die.
Yeah, that's kryptonite to the old school game, that the notion that the guys are going to save the world and stuff. That's something that really came about, I mean, in terms of TSR official stuff, that was Dragonlance that created that spark of the cast of character that's going to save the whole campaign world. And that's something that, if you read even the novels of Gary Gygax, which actually are pretty representative of the way he saw Grey Oak in his mind, you know, the God the Rogue stories. It is not at all about guys that are going to save the world. That becomes that much later in the later books. But that really starts about little guys that are like brigands and thieves who are trying to make it somehow, survive in the world. You know, right? Really representative of the start of the game, right?
And as they level, they might save the world.
That's
but
right.
There's no Tannis half-elvens and...
It's not pre-prepared, right?
Exactly.
That is, you might very well have, in a sandbox, people always talk about, you know, like two opposites. You know, like either you have the hardcore storyline that the characters must follow, or the pure sandbox where suddenly the characters don't even know what to do, right? Because they're like, what are we supposed to do in this world, right? Yeah. Well, the good sandbox in my mind is the one that throws hooks at you all the time, right?
Right, and that's reading your adventure. I see it. I see those hooks in every room. There's like, hey, this thing exploded, and there's a crystal inside. Like,
exactly.
Right. What's that for?
Exactly, right?
It's great.
And from then, the Game Master can just imagine a ton of stuff. Right? If they find a map and the map is not described in the module and it's said explicitly in the module, place a map of your own game in there.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And then you can plug whatever and the players themselves decide if they want to go explore it or not. Right?
Right.
That's cool.
Right. Yeah. So when you're making a map like this or making a new adventure, do you draw the map and look at what you think is cool and then populate it? Or do you make a list of rooms that you think are interesting and then try to fit them into a map? You know, or is it
usually I'm gonna have a concept of what the map is supposed to represent. That is, at least some concept. Like, for instance, for the campaign starter, we're gonna kickstart very soon. When we started the work with Arnie, we had this idea of, okay, it'd be cool to have a dwarven settlement. Okay, and what were they mining? Well, you know, gold and ore and stuff. That would be too obvious. So marble, why not marble? And then what would that look like? Right? So we did a couple of sketches. We were like literally like just talking on Skype like we are doing right now. And I was having like a whiteboard on the side that we could look at together. And I was drawing a sketch of what the place might look like from a bird's eye view, right? From above. And I think that that first map was actually terrible. But that gave us ideas, and from there we imagined what the map, what the place might look like, and what it was used for by the people inhabiting it, like the dwarves and that. And from there, I take the concepts we came up with Ernest. I flesh out the whole map. We look at it again, modify and so on, and then we start rethinking about those particular areas and so what has this become now? Right? Mm-hmm. And so that's how we go about it usually.
Okay. And so you mentioned the Kickstarter that's coming up.
Yeah.
And now that's going to be for the Hobby Shop Dungeon, right? And it's the Marmoreal Tomb of Garn Patul is like
that's right.
The primary dungeon.
That's not the actual Hobby Shop Dungeon itself. The Marmoreal Tomb is just a location that is right next to it in the campaign world. Mm-hmm. Imagine like you had the Temple of Elemental Evil, which would be your main dungeon in your main campaign, and just right next to it in your sandbox you place the Keep on the Borderlands.
Okay.
And that would be the Keep on the Borderlands we're talking about. And the goal, I'm mentioning the Keep on the Borderlands because I think that's basically the perfect campaign starter. And in terms not of detail or anything like that, but in terms of components, we thought a lot about this to build the expanded Marmoreal Tomb. So the it's not a copy at all. Like that's something that Ernie and I would never do. Like we are not about to publish like the new version of the Keep on the Borderlands or the new version like redo the Tomb of Horrors. These are kind of these modules you don't redo. You can't redo the Standing of the Hill Giant Chief.
You know, right.
It's fine as it is, you see?
Yeah.
So our goal is really to add to what the game was at that time, to take the same kind of vision of the game and as if this type of design ethics were going on today. And try to bring them to new gamers who might never have played them in the first place. So the Kickstarter is for that the Tomb of Garn Patul. And so the basic offering for the Kickstarter will be a module that is about like the first level of the Marmoreal Tomb was published in Gygax magazine.
Yes. So number three.
Number three. So there's already a chunk of the tomb that people can readily check out if they want to. What the basic offering of the Kickstarter for funding level, right, without stretch goals or anything, or any gizmos like that, that's going to be twice the amount the very least. So basically, there's going to be a second level and some extra encoders that can move around at the very least. After, if we fund... The sky's the limit, right? We've got some ideas to expand and so on. We've done a lot of work beside, and we'll see if gamers like it, right? So
are you gonna include like a book about your preferred rule sets for the game, or are you gonna?
The intention is and has always been to present the Hobby Shop Dungeon how it was first envisioned. What that means is that we're going to use first edition compatible rules, right? That's going to be presented with Osric, basically. And from there, on top of that, you can have all sorts of guidelines and, to shift editions or to shift games entirely. Right. Mm-hmm. For instance, the first edition game is based around the campaign milieu and exploring a dungeon, and you got roles for wandering monsters and so on. When it shifts to third edition is a game that is basically based on the encoder and balancing the encoder around the challenge writing. So that's the kind of thing we will discuss in guidelines instead of giving us just a suit of a series of numbers. and translation to explain the process behind it, to explain why that is. If you want to shift the edition, you will have to pay attention to this.
Right.
Or force edition, that would be encoder budgets and so on and so forth. Right. So that's just thinking there.
All right. Do you now? Do you DM more than you play, or in locally as far as your home group?
Up until recently, I've always been more of a game master than a player, to be honest. But not so much by choosing, rather than I'm just the guy who runs the game. We all know this guy, right? We all know this,
right.
The guy that that just runs the games and invites people. That's me. When I get the occasion to play, I go for it. For instance, recently I was the player in one of the main players in Arnie's campaign, because I was sort of playing a character, a secondary character, right? I was one of the player characters, but since I knew stuff about the dungeon, I had to keep my mouth shut and not take the lead. So I was playing a cleric for that reason.
Sure.
So I was just healing people, and I might throw something out there if it was not revealing anything about the dungeon. But as a developer on the project with Arnie Gygax, I had to see the dungeon in play. And the best way would be to be a player in it. And that's how that came about.
Yeah. I do the same thing with convention games. I like to have a buddy, Steve, who will play a character. It's kind of like playing an NPC, but he's played through before, so he knows the game. But he's like my plant, so he can help out, heal people, play the cleric.
Yeah.
Play whoever doesn't get picked, as far as that might be needed.
And sometimes,
good thing to have.
Yeah, like I remember an ambush in the game where the group was ambushed by a whole pack of wolves. And I started, my cleric started tossing out oil and stuff. And Arnie was giving me the evil eye. He was saying to me, don't help them. Stop helping them. And I was like, I'm the cleric in the group. And if I see everybody dying, I'm supposed to do something, right? So that is some kind of awkward situations like that sometimes.
Right. You're helping too much.
If you want another story like this, one day Arnie made a call in the game. I absolutely do not remember what it was about. But I was like, one of the players said, well, isn't that working in fact that way in advanced? And I said, yes, it does. Out of my head, that must be Dungeon Master's Guide, page 72 or something like that, right? And Arnie looked at me and said, I'm the DM here. Who, what the hell is this? And one of the players looked at me and said, are you telling me you are rules lowering the son of Gygax? And I had a grin on my face. I was like, yeah, why not?
Let's see what this does.
that might not end well.
No. This. Yeah. That's funny. I remember I asked Ernie if he played with weapon speeds, which is like one of the most crunchy parts of second edition D&D, AD&D, right? Yeah. It's like figuring out your weapon speed, and he's like, oh hell no. Speeds.
Who uses weapon versus armor class tables?
Oh yeah. And calculating that.
But the thing is that the game itself tells you that. If you read the introduction and the conclusion of the Dungeon Master's Guide carefully, it makes a clear distinction between what it calls the framework of the advanced Dungeons & Dragons rules, which are basically these core components that make the game what it is. That is, AC, you have magic users, and you have fighters, and you have clerics and stuff. And the rest, all the fluff around is supposed to be completely changed to fit your campaign. The detail of the rules is not the framework, and vice versa.
Right. So it always says, you can ignore what you don't like.
Yeah.
It's just when you're, you're reading those. And
you always see those arguments online, you know, about how Gygax wanted AD&D to be played that way, not any other way. And other people say, no, that's not true. It's totally up entirely to the DM. Well, not exactly. So, you know, and in fact, it makes this clear separation between the framework and the details of the rules.
Right.
It's both, in fact. Yeah.
Right. Let me ask about the Kickstarter, just as a fan. Are you planning on having, like, big fold-out maps for the memorial tomb? Or, you know, what ideas do you have in your head about how you're going to publish it? Like, is it going to be a little box set or, you know, a book fold-out maps? Or, what's your hope for it anyways?
Yeah, like, if we just fund reasonably and so on, that's going to be like one of those classic TSR modules, you know, with the booklet inside the cover that are not attached to each other, right?
Yeah.
And
the
cover would be printed on both sides with maps, top of it, paper with the actual cover, right? So that would be the basic thing. After, if the dungeon expands, or if we put a lot of bits and pieces into the module, it could become a box set. It could include fold-up maps. We're looking into right now, that's still something that we're not clear on, but that we're still looking into offering like big printout maps, like we can, dungeon, right? Yeah, but it could expand, like on content, it could expand dramatically as well. Huh? That depends exactly how. Because, you know, the more you add to a module like this, that if you add a level to a module, that means that you need to have a map with it. That increases the print cost exponentially, right?
Like, sure.
Right. But we'll see how that successful that is. But at the end of the day, let's imagine that surpasses all our hopes. And boom, right? Which would be super cool. obviously. Then we would have a big dungeon that would be several levels, plus the wilderness around, plus the village to start the adventure in with the NPCs.
Right.
And so on and so forth, right? So
Now is that the Stonecutter clan dwarves as far as the village that you're putting in there?
No, that would be the actual village that would serve as a base to explore the hobby shop dungeon itself as well. So that's why, think about it more as that would be a human village that is populated by Celtic type people, but more on the not quite at medieval level. So
right,
really more natural incline and so on, Buddhism and stuff like that. And there would be opportunities to trade in the village. There would be caravans going through regularly, and so on and so forth. Hire mercenaries and so on and so forth.
Sure. Do you have a name for the village yet? Maybe you don't.
Yes, Kronkemlok.
Oh, Kronkemlok. Okay. Yeah. All right. Awesome.
Yeah. But people ask me all the time, is the hobby shop dungeon named the hobby shop dungeon in the world? Right?
Yeah.
No, it's not, actually. I pop that because like people ask me all the time. The dungeon is named actually in different ways according to who you ask. Because different folk in the world will know the hobby shop dungeon as something different. For instance, some people might refer to it as the Castle Celadon of the color, because of the color of the stone that the castle is made of. The dwarves will call it Nestor's Folly, because the dwarves, the stonecutters, helped Nestor build the first levels of the dungeon and consider them to be insane.
Yeah.
Right? So they just named it Nestor's Folly, right? So,
Oh, awesome. And I do like the idea of a dwarf company that isn't the standard we mine mithril, you know. They look for marble, like they seek out marble as their primary artisan craft. That's great.
That was explicit. That came about very early on when we were discussing the concept of the module. We did not want to default to the miners who have the little cars with the rails and that has been done to death. And we wanted to have something different, but you know, still cool and dwarven. And that's what happened, right?
Yeah, yeah. I have a good friend who played a dwarf back in our early days, who was a dwarven carpenter, and it was so, which is unusual because dwarves, you know, it's all about stone and gems, and so he never had any work. That's why he had to go adventuring, because he was a carpenter, and they never build rails on anything. You've seen this, you know, the stairs in dwarven tombs.
Yeah.
There's no wooden rails on them. That's very unsafe. But
I could totally see. In the Hobby Shop Dungeon world, I could totally see a clan of dwarves of shipwrights. That would be awesome.
Yeah, right?
That makes sense. You know, like they build stuff, and maybe they're also afraid of water, like traditional dwarves. But they build the ships. You see, like
and they build them to carry really heavy cargo.
That's right.
Like they specialize.
Build the stuff,
in...
but you guys, humans, you can try the ship and tell us if it works. You know, like
Oh, that's good stuff. All right. Oh, so we are at the point in the podcast where I want to do the Vorpal Chainsword Quiz Blast.
I'm worried about this.
Okay.
Go ahead.
All right. Well, there's 7 questions. You just try to answer them as best as you can.
Okay.
And of course, there are right and wrong answers, even though they're totally opinions on your part. Okay. So, question number one.
Yeah.
Preferred two-weapon combo, long sword and short sword, or battle axe and hand axe?
So the first choice is what, long sword and short sword?
Yeah.
That's the one I take.
Okay. The good old standard.
Oh, yeah. And that works well.
Yeah, it is.
And there's no better weapon than the long sword in the game.
Just because you can find... Magic longswords are like the most primary.
Yes, absolutely, yes.
Have proficiency in longsword. That's the rule of any D&D fighter warrior character.
If you want to really optimize, you go like longsword, shield, obviously, because magic shields are going to buff you like crazy as a fighter, right?
Yeah.
And so on. Plate.
All right, this one is going to call on your knowledge of the old school... Fiend Folio.
Okay.
But tougher old school dungeon monster, the Lurker or the Trapper? Do you recall what those are?
No. Out of my mind right now, no.
Yeah, it's a hard one. The Lurker is the floor that comes to life.
Right.
And wraps around you, and the Trapper is the ceiling that drops on you. Which one is tougher?
Is that the ceiling that's the toughest of the two?
It is not the ceiling. It is the floor. The floor has 12 hit dice. The ceiling has 10 hit dice. Either way.
Here goes my old school cred.
Right. Right. Well, I mean, I'm the one answering the question, so I can seem like I know what
that's
I'm talking
right,
about.
Exactly.
But obviously, I had the book out. Yeah.
And I love the Fiend Folio, by the way.
I do too, yeah. But that the Lurker was always scarier. It's like, you don't want the ceiling to drop on you. That's weird. But the floor coming to life, you just hack at the floor like you're not worried about it.
I love this kind of monsters. Like like the Mimic or, you know, even the Rot Grubs or stuff like that. I love this kind of...
Yeah.
All these kind of monsters that... The parts of the decor that screw with you. I love this.
Or that... Or the slow-moving gelatinous cube that just slithers down towards you while the...
I had an awesome gelatinous cube. Like, maybe it's in the Hyperborean labs. A gelatinous cube that basically got frozen.
Uh-huh.
And with a body inside. And so the body is basically frozen in place.
Uh-huh.
And you can't see the gelatinous cube, right? But when you approach the body, suddenly you touch the cube and the cube cracks. And all the cracks grow on the cube. As if in thin air.
Oh, because it's completely invisible.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
And poof, suddenly, the blob of jello comes into being, right? Boom. And that's how I played it in the game. That's awesome.
And just, they're disgusting.
That's one of the best.
They engulf you, like.
Yeah.
Okay, that was question number two.
Sorry. I tried.
Question three.
Yes.
Deck of many things or Wand of Wonder?
Wand of Wonder.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you don't want to just destroy the campaign with the deck of many things.
No. That's, you got to be crazy to play with the... But you know what? You always need that player. the crazy player that's gonna play with the deck of many things, or I call that player the lever puller. No, that you have the lever in the dungeon, and you ask the player, so what do? And there's gonna be one guy who's gonna get bored and says, well, I just pull it.
Yeah, because everybody else is studying.
You need this guy. As a TM, I love this because, like, something happens, right?
And it's always, you're in a room filled with portcullises to cells filled with zombies. There's a lever in the center. Do you want to pull it? Everybody's like, oh, no, we don't pull it. And one guy's like, "Is it? What color is the lever? Like, the lever's red. And he's like, I pull it. Like, you know what's going to happen. Anyway. All right. We're going to move on from D&D with these questions. Mm-hmm. Better heroine. So movies. Sarah Connor or Ellen Ripley?
Ellen Ripley.
Yes. Yeah, that's a good one. All right.
It's Ripley.
It's like aliens. It's just can't stop. Okay. Here's a question. Do you drink too much coffee or drink too much stout? To paraphrase Foggy Molly.
That's a hard one, actually. I drink too much coffee.
Yeah, it's me too. Yeah. Coffee or stout. All right. Arkham Horror or Settlers of Catan?
I go with Settlers of Catan. Actually, I was playing with the auditors will not be able to see, but I was playing with.
Oh, you have a Settlers of Catan deck right in front of you, like the hexagons you just held up.
That's right.
I was just playing Settlers of Catan this morning. Yeah, Settlers of Catan, definitely. Because as fun as Arkham Horror is, at least you've played Settlers of Catan once a year at minimum, right? Setting up Arkham Horror is like.
Yeah, that's right. There's much more investment, and you need to be with gamers who are already
much you more can't have any people with the attention span of the lever puller in a group playing Arkham Horror, because the game will just...
And really, as far as board games are concerned, I usually prefer casual games. I'm not much into like really complex board games. Unless we're talking about wargaming. That's another thing entirely, right? Advanced squad leader. Let's do this, man.
All flavors of Axis and Allies. Every year of World War II. There are 7 versions of that game. It's like 1939, 1941. Like, not 1941, 1942, but they have the whole game for like single years.
We're going to play Teletubbies, Axis and Allies.
All right, last question, and this is going to be more regional for you. Well, to ask, what is it called, a Sasquatch or a Wendigo?
Slathla.
A Sasquatch?
Slathla.
What's that? Is that another dialect for
that? Yes. That's the Elsook language, just off the coast here, and what people know as Sasquatch is named Slathla. That's T-H-L-A. And that's the Yeti, the Sasquatch. But here, to answer your question, clearly between the two choices, that would be Sasquatch.
Right. But really, the Fafa, I thought it was Wendigo up in your area, but...
No, actually, the guys, the name Sasquatch comes from, as far as I know, comes from Vancouver, actually. Like the actual nation that named the creature Sasquatch is in the area of Vancouver, just outside of the valley, actually.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Now, anyway... Well, that was just...
So that's Slathla here. This creature is... Yeah, this creature is... You're going to find it in many First Nations and with different names or attributes or... Yeah. Mm.
And we should point out, for the listeners who don't know, you're up in... up near Vancouver? Is that...
No. I'm on the central coast of British Columbia. I'm about... I'm really up north from Vancouver. And I live on reservation, actually. I'm in the First Nation land.
Oh, really?
And
my
wife is a teacher on reservation.
Okay.
At the local school. And so, I've been living on reservation for 15 years now.
Oh, wow. Then I am not questioning your pronunciation of what Sasquatch is called up there. You are, you have it. You know it. I knew you lived in British Columbia, but I didn't know you lived that far north.
Hear the French accent.
Yeah.
Father smelt of elderberries.
Right. I'm counting that as correct. My mother was a hamster. All right. So it looks like you got 6 out of 7 right, and you only got one wrong because I asked you a totally ancient monster question about the lurker and the.
Well, if you had asked about the original booklets or something like that, I might have. But Feedfolio, you know, like with Arnie, usually that's when we start looking at Feedfolio. Arnie tells me, you know, that's that UK book. I don't know if we should pick creatures from Feedfolio. And I'm like, what are you talking about? Feedfolio is cool.
Yeah. Some of those monsters, I don't get what they were thinking. There's like a bunny that sits on a stump that has tentacles underneath. I'm not sure what that's called. I don't recall.
That creature appears in Expedition of to the Barrier Peak, I think.
To the Barrier Peak?
Yeah. Isn't it in the area where the garden of the ship is located? And there's that stump with the rabbit on top?
Yeah, that's the monster. Yeah, that's the monster. Like, weirdest thing. Cause the stump is also part of the monster.
What is that thing
called? Anyway, I don't remember.
Now some weird creatures in there, yes.
Yeah. So you say you play wargaming. Besides Axis and Allies, do you paint any miniatures or do Warhammer or anything like that as far as wargaming?
I paint miniatures, but for role playing, yes.
Yeah, for role playing. Okay. But any for wargaming at all? Or we all used to do it for wargaming maybe before we started, you know.
Actually, I haven't done so much miniature wargaming. I did some chainmail, obviously, but I kind of consider it, you know, the Salmos D&D for me. But if Jeff Perrin heard me right now, he would smack me on the back of the head. In terms of wargaming, no, I was much more into Cheat and Excess. Actually, I was playing much more Cheat and Excess at the time.
Okay.
That's I used to do that a lot. Right, I just reacquired Alexander the Great.
Oh, really?
And yes, I still haven't given it a try. I want to, really badly. Yeah.
Right, but you have to pull in some people for those games that are willing to.
I tried to pervert my wife, and actually she got me the. Yeah, I would try it.
Oh, really? Yeah. Set aside an entire Saturday. And
that's
maybe
right.
Some of Sunday.
That's right.
But sure. Of course, that puts it on you to learn the rules intricately enough to explain them, right? That's the other problem with those games is.
Well, it's kind of cool. Well, it's also an opportunity because when you figure out the rules, the two of you together, two players together, that makes it cooler because you don't get the feeling of really being bookish and trying to figure things out in the abstract, you know, like you can actually, okay, so maybe that works that way. You go through the ranks and you're like, okay, no, maybe that's not supposed to work that easy.
I wanted to ask you, do you play any other systems at all? Any RPG systems like Dungeon World or Fate or Hollow Earth Expedition or anything besides D&D?
I'm actually a huge fan of a ton of. I don't know if I can show you. Wait, if I can turn this. This is part of my collection here.
Right. Okay, so a giant.
So yeah, like
that's
a giant...
really high ceiling. That bookcase goes like 15 feet in the air.
To answer your question, yeah, I'm rather on the traditional side of gaming, but I don't mind some narrative games sometimes. I actually liked quite a bit Numenera and The Strange.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I think I was very skeptical about it because of the narrative bent at first. Mm. And when I looked into it, I thought, wow, that's a really well thought out. It's a really cool setup, right? Like, I mean, Numenera is a very imaginative take on the far future and so on. Mm-hmm. You can clearly feel some inspiration from Jack Vance and so on. The Strange also has a very cool take on alternate dimensions and investigators jumping from world to world and so on. That's pretty cool. So those two would be recent games. But in terms of traditional games, I'm a huge fan of Call of Cthulhu. I love other Chaosium games like Stormbringer. Oakmoon, RunQuest, the 6th edition of RunQuest that came out by the design mechanism is actually pretty good.
Yeah.
I like Cyberpunk. I'm just looking off here. Cyberpunk 2020.
Sure.
I love that game.
There's a video game based on it that's been, you know, about to come out for about 3 years now.
2077 or something.
2099.
Like... Right.
Oh, wait, no, 2077. You're right. 2077.
Yeah. So yeah, no, I can't wait to see what. Yeah. I mean, you know, Pondsmith is working on it and so on. So I have no idea what that's going to look like, but that looks awesome.
Right.
We're going to
see,
right?
Yeah. Anything cyberpunk, I'm completely on board with.
Like, I love this.
If I'm scrolling through Netflix movies or like looking through bad movies to watch, and one of them, the art even kind of looks like it's cyberpunk,
yeah.
You know, even though it stars Gary Busey or like, I'll put it in and I will watch it. Like anything. Is there a neon sign on there? I'm in.
Blade Runner.
Yeah.
Fantastic movie.
Yeah.
Like in recent games as well, Eclipse Phase. I like that game.
Eclipse Phase. That's a complex one. I'm not
mentioning Astonishing Swordsman and Sorcerers of Hyperborea or DCC RPG. You know?
Right, yeah.
Those are kind of obvious for D&D era. But, so other games like that. Well, I like the other games of Gygax, like Dangerous Journeys.
Right, Dangerous Journeys.
Right? I like French games as well, which some people might not be so... Well, In Nomine Satanis Magna Veritas is known in the U.S. as In Nomine.
Okay.
By Steve Jackson Games.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, that's...
That's that huge hardcover book, right? The book is like this big.
In France, it's actually a box set of just very slim booklets. Actually, the two versions are completely different because the U.S. version was very... stripped of all its satirical humor, because the French version basically it's a game where you play angels and demons.
Yeah, yeah.
Waging war on Earth, and the French game is super satirical about French society, politics, and all that, mm-hmm. and huge cliches and zingers and all that. And so all that dimension was taken out of the game when it transitioned to Steve Jackson Games, mm-hmm. because they thought apparently that the U.S. audiences would not react well to it.
Oh.
Right? Uh-huh. And that's really too bad because like the original French game is really hilarious. Like it's really you should have a good sense of humor, right? Because
right.
it can be easily offensive. But yeah. Once you're into that, that's awesome.
Nice. All right. Okay, you say you play Call of Cthulhu. Do you ever now that's a very different game to run than D&D, right? Because you do have to have a story there. And it has to be based around the characters. Well, I mean Not necessarily,
actually. Like, you look at a campaign like The Masks of Nyarlathotep.
Okay, yeah, that's a big one. That's a
But basically, you do have a backstory to the whole thing, mm-hmm. and what happened to the expedition, Carlisle, blah blah blah.
Yeah, okay.
But the freedom of the characters to go from this city to that city to care about this aspect of what's going on in, say, New York rather than Kenya or whatnot, that's a very open type of campaign.
Oh, so, yeah, that's true.
Yeah. So when I run Call of Cthulhu, I usually set up a basic situation. Like, I know what's going on. You know, like, there's a guy in a haunted mansion that disappeared and blah, blah.
Right.
Right? And from there, the situation is basically open. I know what's going on behind the scenes and how it's going to play out if the players don't do anything.
Right.
And from there, that's just the contact of the world with the player characters. Right.
Right. So it's up to the players who goes down into the basement to get attacked by the floating knife.
That's right.
Exactly. Right.
If that would be the less sanity lost. Then.
Right. That would be the ideal situation to be attacked
by
the telekinetic knife.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Now I want to ask: is there anything you want to mention that is upcoming, or anything besides? I mean, we know the Kickstarter is happening. Or is there anything of other people's work you want to like give a shout out to that people may not be aware of, or things that might not be getting
Well, it's going to be over by the time. The
Lost City of Gaxmore is what you're going to say, right?
Just that, the last few hours, really.
Yep.
I was very much into Rob Schwalbe new game, Shadow of the Demon Lord. Okay. I thought the idea was pretty interesting. What I wanted to mention is that really the Kickstarter that's going to happen in the Marmoral Tomb of Gampatul, it's really something that can be used on its own or as an introduction to the greater dungeon, which will come later. And really, that's something that is extremely intended to be modular for Game Master. So if you want to use one level here, one level there, you want to take it apart, and so on and so forth. It's organized in a way that allows very easy use that way. I also wanted to mention that really this Kickstarter is going to open up a lot of possibilities because the way that's going to unfold as we're thinking about it now, that's we have the Marmoral Tomb of Gampatul, right, with the campaign starter and so on. Then we will have the first part of the Dungeon Hobby Shop. Then we will have the setting, which would be like a kind of gazetteer, kind of like the Greyhawk gazetteer of 1980, the World of Greyhawk. And then we're going to have the official dungeon, the second part, which would be like the gigantic sixth level. And after that, we're going to have the other modules, right? Including the Halls of the Big Arcane and so on and so forth. So what I'm trying to point out is that, it's not just about the Marmoral Tomb of Gampatul, in that this Kickstarter is the opening salvo, and that opens up a whole host of possibilities after that, if it succeeds.
Right, and I think it will. I mean, the level of excitement for at Gary Con or Game Hole Con when Ernie's running a game of Hobby Shop Dungeon is palpable. Like people are watching. They're just standing there around the table, you know, and even though there's like nine players, people are still standing around the table, like watching what's happening.
Great for me to hear this because when I'm not around, like I'm getting feedback from people who have been at the table on social media or whatnot.
Yeah.
But then I'm not there and I'm not feeling those kind of,
You're not getting the thing. In-person vibe.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's also something to know. Well, I am super excited about it. Ernie is as well. We're also a little bit afraid because there's always that chance that, you know, it's going to bomb so badly. Of course, you're working for that to not happen, right?
Right.
We're getting so close and we're getting there, man.
Yeah, it's exciting. And what I've noticed over the last couple of years, this might be a perfect time for it too, because the local gaming conventions in the Midwest, at least, have been really blowing up. I think Gen Con, you know, the central gaming convention is kind of, people want to go to these local events, and then suddenly they find out they can meet Ernie there, they can meet, you know, Tom Wham there, Ed Greenwood's coming to it, and then I think the old school gaming style that these guys bring is vamping up a lot. I've really noticed that myself.
I really think there's a conjunction of different things that come together right now. Dads that have played the old games who are introducing them to their kids. You've got these people who have come to role-playing via third edition.
Right,
D&D, who are not trying to explore other versions of the game or have tried fifth edition and are like, okay, I have different versions of the game now. Maybe I could find out about this advanced game, what it was about.
Yeah.
So you got a lot of things that are, the diversity of the hobby is exploding right now. And that's a good thing. You got all these things that are coming together, and I think there's a big opportunity to bring back the old school style of games, which a huge number of gamers out there have never even heard about, right?
Right.
You can mention Tensor and stuff like everybody would know Tensor. But when you come down to how was Gary Gygax playing the game, right? And stuff like there are a lot of assumptions around it. But there are many people who still wonder exactly what the little brown booklets were about and how do you play that. It sounds weird. It doesn't sound even playable when you read the booklets.
Right.
Like, Are you playing this with chainmail or without chainmail?
Right. And the way you have the caves written the Hyperborean Laboratory, the descriptions of the rooms aren't necessarily setting specific. So even the people that are in the Pathfinder RPGA system,
that would be different from the lab, Hyperborean Labs, in that yes, the description of the rooms will be set at a default as they were in the Gygax magazine. So that will be more set in that sense. But at the same time around, and I was talking about it a bit with the fans because I wanted to know how they felt about it and how to actually make that work from a structural point of view and layout. Mm-hmm. And what we're probably going to do is have suggestions in the margins of the module to customize this or that area.
Sure.
Right. And at the end of the module, I have more general advice about what if you shift the dungeon to sci-fi or space opera.
Yeah.
I actually talked about running the Hobby Shop dungeon with Star Wars.
Wow.
And
awesome.
People were like, this is insane. That can't work. And I was like, yes, it can work. What if you have a field of asteroid? And those are the remnants of Caliban.
Right.
And yeah, one of the stories has a castle on it, right? Yeah. And that's an old Sith castle. Mm-hmm. And that's the Hobby Shop dungeon, and you just reskin it for Star Wars. With droids and stuff. And yeah, it could work.
Yeah, it definitely could work. I can see why you like Numenara.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, isn't that, but yeah, even in the write-ups you have, in the hobby shop, and I'm sure it's going to be like this, there's suggestions of ancient worlds or other portals to other worlds. I think there's a Mygo in there, you know, from Pluto, right? So
that's so, part of the design of the world itself. Yes, that's thank you for bringing that up, because I think that's something that's going to be very interesting, in the sense that, you know, we wanted in a way to be to have the campaign world with be the antithesis of Dragonlance, in the sense that we wanted to make the customization by game masters part of the canon of the world. That is, whatever change you make to the world, it is canon by default, like by the description of the world itself. So the way we made that work is by bringing up a concept of shades of the earth that are like piled up on top of each other. And there's an area very close to the dungeon that's called the Wild, which is like a swamp area that is imbued with chaos. And the planes of existence basically constantly shift into one another. So you could have two game masters in your town running the Hobby Shop dungeon two completely different ways, and have the character shift from one table to the other, and just come up with an excuse. Well, they went in the wild, they got lost, and they ended up in the other version of the Hobby Shop dungeon.
Right, they dimensionally shifted. That's great. Yeah, I love that idea of quantum time events happening.
Right. So yeah. By default, and you want I was joking, I'm going to try to do it at some point in the module. I only thought I was crazy, but I wanted to put a Sherman tank inside a dungeon.
Oh, that's great. Just rust it out.
Right, exactly. With just a few shells remaining, right? So that the party could actually use it.
Oh, yeah.
Right, and shoot stuff in the dungeon with it. And Ollie was like, you insane, man. I was like, yeah, that's cool, man.
Yeah.
And I'm going to try to make it happen in one of our modules, because I thought that would be so fun.
It would be. And if they, because those players are going to keep those, they're going to be like two shells, right, or three, and they'll be so precious.
Right, exactly, yeah.
They're not going to waste
it. You can blow entire walls and create new passages in the dungeon and stuff. That would be awesome.
And then you're just thinking, where did this come from? Like, does this, it's temporarily shifted from modern day or 1940s Earth, like, wow.
I run the Hobby Shop dungeon in a game in Call of Cthulhu, in France, 1910, during the Great Flooding of Paris, and the Hobby Shop dungeon was from the Fey world and had bled into the reality of 1910.
Oh, nice.
And I had a character of my campaign of astonishing swordsmen and sorcerers of Hyperborea that got lost in our real world and was trying to find the Hobby Shop dungeon to get back to his plane.
Wow.
So that's an example of using the Hobby Shop dungeon out of the box and going...
Oh, yeah. I love that idea of the... And really emphasizing that it can exist in different dimensions at the same time will make it more fun. And the people playing it will feel like, oh, you're playing in the Hobby Shop dungeon too.
And we're
both canon. That's a great idea.
And that's not just the genre or the setting that you're using. That can be the playstyle too. Like we were talking earlier about how the modules of old are really about exploring and so on. Mm-hmm. But let's say you're using something like Fate.
Yeah.
Or something that is much more built around the idea that you build the story around the game table and so on. You could use the Hobby Shop Dungeon as an element of decor, a meaningful place for the story to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
So you could say some NPCs or whatnot have some sort of plot that revolves around some specific NPCs in the dungeon, and from there weave the story with the rest of the people. It's all in the way you approach the thing. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
And so part of the advice that we want to bring up in the module and in the Hobby Shop Dungeon later is just to say, hey, if you shift the assumptions of the game and the playstyle this or that way, here's how you can use the dungeon.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, awesome. And I like the idea that the Hobby Shop Dungeon is just kind of the name we do use for it, but in each of these worlds it has a different name.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
And we wanted
to keep the original name of the dungeon Hobby Shop, mm-hmm. but then that's something that came to us like, well, it wouldn't be the dungeon like the dungeon of the Hobby Shop dungeon anymore.
Right.
So we shifted it around. That would be any Hobby Shop's dungeon.
Yeah.
So, and also in the advice to run the dungeon, what we want to do is explain how to run big dungeon games like this in the Hobby Shop.
Right. And like, keep track
of open tables, yeah. right? Yeah. With players changing from one session to the next. How to yeah. keep it going and so on. So
yeah. Yeah. That's awesome. All right. Right. Well, that's a great ender on that. I have the dimensional shifting of the Hobby Shop.
I'm stoked about it. Yeah, we had a good conversation, man.
Yeah, yeah. I want to thank you for coming on the podcast. It was I had a really good time.
Pleasure.
And I really look forward to the Kickstarter, and I know a lot of other people do too. So we're all very excited for it. So thank you for
Go ahead. When it comes out, and if you follow us on Facebook, we are the Hobby Shop Dungeon. You can find us that way. We have a page. We have the website gp-adventures.com.
Mm-hmm.
And when that comes about, we're going to start posting everywhere. Hopefully, word of mouth in this hobby is everything. So if you can like, share. Well, that's really critical. Really, I think we need more gamers to understand this. That really sharing the crap out of the things you love, because there are gamers that you know that might not know about what you know, right?
Right.
I sound like a Rumsfeld right now. But
the unknown unknowns.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
But yeah, like it's all about getting the eyeballs to see. Wow. That actually exists, right?
Right. Because, even like the Facebook algorithm is mutating every day, so
yes.
people won't see what you see in your newsfeed, even though you're subscribed to the same pages sometimes. So liking it and sharing it makes it more likely that
unless
someone...
Unless you pay me a bunch of dollars. And then
right, unless you boost the post, right? God.
Thank you, Facebook.
Yeah.
Hi.
Right.
That said, Facebook is a great platform for this.
Yeah.
Because I think there's a dimension to Facebook, like the personal aspect of Facebook, that people use their real name and post pictures of their puppies
mm-hmm.
Instead of Google+, which is much more circle built. And
right.
so you have a tendency to have the geeks together and the football players together, and or Tumblr, where it's really about the macros and the picture that you post and whatnot.
Right.
Facebook has this really intimate approach of being friends that I think is great to the hobby that way.
Mm-hmm.
That's just my personal take on it. I really like to be on Facebook to talk about the hobby.
Right, and people can post on, if you share something that someone else sees, someone that's not necessarily a friend, but also likes that page can post on it, and then you can actually interact with new people, and that's
exactly the circles thing on Google+ has its own advantages to be able to separate the wheat from the chaff and really have focused conversations with the people you want, right and that's an asset, but that comes with its own lot of flaws, right, in which if you want to have voices from the outside and you really want to open yourself to a great number of gamers that with completely different playstyles or whatnot, then that can become an obstacle.
Yeah.
At least in my experience.
No, I think it's an accurate description of how those are working or how they're evolving anyway. Yeah. And Facebook still is the best place to have like a page like the Hobby Shop Dungeon page or a company page.
This conversation is never going to end.
I know. I'm sorry.
No. That's my pleasure. I started it again. Sorry.
No. It's a good point. It's a good point that sharing this stuff on Facebook, and that's what I was going to say, was people now have a thousand friends where they used to have their high school classmates or whatever, and now they have, like, I have a lot of friends that I've never met in person or I've met at cons that then comment on something that we meet through a page like that. And now what's beneficial about that is then they drown out all the baby pictures of people from your high school reunion, which is great. But it also means that if you do see something you think is great, then definitely share it like this.
Yeah, because, absolutely.
Because then other people will see it. Otherwise, it gets buried in the noise.
It's all about the word of mouth.
Yeah.
That's why whenever I see a publisher or a game designer, I won't name names, but who goes about shitting over a whole section of gamers or has a rant about how the plebs don't understand what it is like to be a game publisher or whatnot. I just don't understand this because it's like really like, that's like having a dump in your bowl of soup.
Right. Yeah. Your own.
I don't understand because like fundamentally we're all people who love games and stuff and yeah, so I just don't get it.
There's nothing you want to do more than if you're by yourself at a convention or in a place and someone you can tell someone likes something that you like and you start to have a conversation about it. Yeah. How exciting that is to have the same conversation you've had with your friends a thousand times,
right,
but with a new person who has a different take on it.
The internet is great for breaking down barriers. Mm-hmm. Like, for instance, about the old guard, the guys like Ernie or Tim Kask or, you know, there's always this tendency to believe these guys are standing on a pedestal and are like, you know, like superhuman. And, man, what will he think of me if I start talking to him? And I don't want to come off as like a goof and stuff. Well, these people are just people like you and I, really. Like, you've experienced it with Ernie, I'm sure.
Right.
And that the internet is great for that, to break down those barriers and look at people that you've admired all your life or you played the modules of or whatnot as normal people.
Yeah.
And that's great. That's awesome. That.
Yeah. And
love that about this.
And speaking to those guys, you realize, oh, wait, these are guys, they like the same stuff I like, part of which because they wrote some of it. But
that's right.
You know, they're excited about the same kind of crap that you're excited
about. You talk
about
say... Try to talk to Luke or Ernie about Big Trouble in Little China.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. I know Luke Gygax is a huge fan of the movie and Ernie too.
Yeah, and
they're gonna go, oh, it's an awesome movie.
Yeah.
And it is an awesome movie, right?
Right.
But I mean like 10-15 years ago, we might not have thought about it, you know, like what would it be like to talk to a Gygax? And talk about Big Trouble in Little China. You see what I mean? Like, and that's stuff that happens all day long now on Facebook. And that's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, it is awesome. That is a good point. I didn't realize they're fans of Big Trouble in Little China. But then again, why would I assume they wouldn't be? You know,
I mean, Big Trouble in Little China is probably one of my favorite movies of all time. It makes it in my top 20 easy.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. Top 20 for sure.
Yeah.
What's your number one? Okay, last question. What's your number one favorite movie in the world?
The Adventures of Robin Hood with Errol Flynn. I'm serious. Errol Flynn?
Yeah.
No, Errol Flynn.
Like
yeah,
the, what was it, like 1936 or something? Or
33, yeah.
33.
And that's my favorite movie of all time. I've watched it hundreds of times.
Oh, wow. That's...
I love this movie. That's for me. And I watched it when I was a teenager every Wednesday afternoon because that's when we didn't have school in France. I would watch it religiously. Like, I would just, like, barf myself with, cookies or whatnot, and I would watch Robin Hood. And I had no idea that Robin Hood was actually a movie that had inspired part of the original game.
Oh,
because the way armor class works, or the feel of the combat of Dungeons and Dragons,
mm-hmm.
comes in part from these kind of movies. And actually, Errol Flynn itself played a part in it. In the, you know, the sword fight they have at the end, you know, in the castle, like Guy of Gisborne and Robin Hood are going at it with their sword, you know. And that was part of the inspiration of the whole how should combat feel in Dungeons & Dragons, right? The hit points and, you know, so you have hit point thing that wears down.
Right.
It's not really wounds.
Yeah.
Right? That's more like you're wearing down and stuff. And then when you go below zero HP, boom, that's when you're actually hit by the sword.
Right. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Oh, I didn't know that. I didn't know that movie was a major inspiration to that.
That was part of it. Yeah.
That's a really good answer to that question. My answer feels so weak now.
What's your favorite movie?
It's Army of Darkness, starring Bruce Campbell.
Oh, that's an awesome movie.
Yeah.
Can I change my answer? No.
No.
It's a terrific movie.
Yeah. A lot less meaning to that, though.
This is Boomstick.
Yeah.
That's just a terrific movie, though.
Yeah. All right, well, I want to thank you for coming on the podcast. And I had a great time talking with you. And game on.
All right.
All right. Have a good one, Benoit.
Bye-bye.